are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the December 4th, 2023 Monday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop. Today we will be reading the following main articles: Ornamental and Spiritual, by Megan Ululani Boyanton of the Denver Post; Israel Widens Attack in Gaza, by Najib Jobain and Karim Chahayeb of the Associated Press; Group Targets Childhood Vaccination Mandates, by Cheryl Gay Stolberg of the New York Times; Cities Cracking Down on Homeless Encampments, by Claire Rush, Janie Haar, and Michael Casey of the Associated Press; and Following Up with Miscellaneous Articles. Ornamental and Spiritual. Plant has growing following because of its appearance and psychedelic properties, by Megan Ululani Boyanton of the Denver Post. At Nick's Garden Center and Farm Market in Aurora, it takes some searching to find the few San Pedro cacti for sale inside of the sprawling greenhouse. On Tuesday afternoon, fresh Christmas wreaths and holiday decorations garnered more attention from customers of the nursery at 2001 South Chambers Road than the shelves of cacti displayed farther back. Even as two women paused to peer at eye-catching varieties like golden barrel cactus, the spiky green San Pedro cacti sat largely unnoticed among more than 200 other plants. "I think it's beautiful, but it doesn't have any shocking features," horticulturist Colette Haskell, 49, said. "Still, when the garden center stocks up on San Pedro cacti or Trichocereus, they definitely do sell out pretty quickly," she added. An enthusiastic following of both professional and amateur horticulturalists is growing around the cacti, as they largely prize it for its appearance. But with the recent decriminalization of certain natural psychedelics in Colorado, interest in San Pedro cacti is rising for another reason. It's a source of mescaline, a hallucinogen that can result in euphoric feelings, a boost in energy, distortions of space, time, and perception, nausea, and more. Native to South America, the San Pedro cacti is illegally poached for its mescaline, as is the peyote cacti or Lophophora williamsi, a plant endemic to the southern U.S. and northern Mexico that's considered a religious sacrament by some Native Americans. Horticulturists and members of the Native American Church worry about how to effectively keep these plants around for years to come, but Colorado's growers see hope in their survival. "People who are into houseplants again," Haskell said, "it's like the 70s all over again. Store-bought versus homegrown. Typically, Nick's customers choose San Pedro cacti for collective purposes, religious reasons, and preventative measures to keep it from extinction," Haskell said. "The business purchases from professional growers certified by the U.S. Agriculture Department to grow the plants from seeds, not people who harvest wild cacti. It can only buy them in limited amounts because they grow slowly and they shouldn't be harvested irresponsibly," Haskell said. She pointed to one real fear in her industry: plant poaching. "You can't just buy from some guy who comes in and says he's got all these San Pedros," she added. Among the seven in stock, the smallest at 6 inches tall was priced at $44.99, while the largest, towering over patrons in its 7-gallon pot, could be bought for $429.99. Meanwhile, Jacob Laura, a 28-year-old Denverite, sells San Pedro cacti fully rooted at $15 per foot on Facebook Marketplace, with his plants ranging in height from 6 inches to more than 2 feet. "In California, you'll find, I'm talking like 8 to 10-foot San Pedro cactuses in people's front yards," he said. "I did not have perfect growing conditions, so his cacti usually reach an average size. Many of his customers are other plant cultivators. There's not really a very big psychedelic culture around mescaline," Laura said. "It's still kind of like a very elusive hallucinogen." Last year, Coloradans voted to decriminalize the personal possession, growing, use, and sharing of mescaline for adults, along with several other naturally occurring psychedelics, through the passage of Proposition 122. The sale of these psychedelics and any underage access remains illegal, with the federal government labeling mescaline a Schedule I substance under the Controlled Substances Act. A lot of people in this subculture really value just the aesthetic of the plants, Laura said. I've met nobody that cultivates them for the mescaline. Proposition 122. The 2022 National Survey on Drug Use and Health reported that about 8.5 million Americans aged 12 and older who partake in illicit drugs over 1 year's time consumed hallucinogens. Mescaline isn't asked about specifically because it's not that prevalent at all, said Joshua Kipple, attorney and founding partner of cannabis and psychedelics law firm Vicent LLP. He said hundreds of cacti species contain various amounts of mescaline, with the plants legally sold across the U.S. Even before Proposition 122 passed, people have been selling San Pedro cactus in Colorado for decades. It's not like this is something new, Kipple said. A lot of people buy these cactuses and don't know that they even contain mescaline. He called mescaline's overall legal status incredibly gray. You can't sell natural medicines in Colorado, Kipple said, but the commonly accepted status is that you can grow cacti containing mescaline for ornamental purposes. Special protections are given to the peyote cacti with exceptions for religious uses of peyote by the Native American Church, Kipple said. Original plant stewards. The Native American Church considers peyote a sacred being, and mescaline is part of that being, said Troy, the last captive of the Comanches, taken in the old way by Ivaya and brought into the Ononon band of Namunu as Kwiwanai Makwitsoy Akwituni, he who saves the eagle from the water. He also just goes by Troy. Where the peyote grows is our homeland, he said. As a Kiwania Puhakat, or eagle priest, Troy's part of the Pia Puhakani, Mother Church of the Comanche Native American Church. The Comanche people settled in southwest Oklahoma after moving across the Plain States, including Colorado. They've long held ceremonies where all are welcome to pray, sing, and eat peyote, according to the Comanche National Museum and Cultural Center. The creator also said, when you eat the peyote, you will know me. And in South America, pre-Columbian cultures similarly used San Pedro cacti for rituals, with shamans still turning to them today for healing purposes. This name, San Pedro, is an allusion to St. Peter's role as the gatekeeper to heaven, the Journal of Ethnopharmacology says. The ritual includes sniff tobacco with alcohol, ingest San Pedro, pinpoint the diseases, cleanse the evil, and flourish the sick person, according to the National Library of Medicine. The longer a cactus has been stored, the stronger and the higher its content in mescaline-derived alkaloids will be, with an individual cactus's mescaline content also varying based on its environmental temperature, levels of rainfall, and more. Mescaline can be consumed as a powder, tablet, capsule, or liquid, with the option to chew peyote fresh or dried, the Alcohol and Drug Foundation says. The decriminalization of mescaline and other naturally occurring psychedelics puts a deeper stress on these plant medicines, with thieves stealing the San Pedro and peyote cacti, Troy said. Instead, he's pushing for the societal acceptance of synthetic alternatives like LSD, which remains illegal, to mitigate the damage to nature. However, if people want to grow things, I really don't have a problem with that, Troy said. That would help the destruction of these different natural areas to slow down. He's working to support indigenous communities that serve as original plant stewards through benefit honoring, the practice of individuals, medical and psychedelic companies donating percentages of their incomes to create land trusts, build conservation infrastructure for sacred plants, and more. Maybe one day. North of the Colorado line in Cheyenne, 34-year-old Joshua Church grows San Pedro cacti, which occupy a sentimental place in his heart. In 2019, he proposed to his now wife at the Grand Canyon in Arizona. Afterward, they visited their first cactus nursery and spent about $400 on the spiny plants. 2 years later, their daughter was born with a natural green thumb. Church called her very much involved, even only at 2 years old. He estimates that around 80% of San Pedro cacti cultivators grow them because of their love for the plant. While some of the people that have been growing for years and years, they do partake in mescaline, propagating them solely for that reason is considered more of a newbie thing, Church said. He sells boxes made up of San Pedro cacti, succulents, and other cactus variations, collector's items, which average in price between $95 to $120 per box. He turned down would-be customers who've tried to buy his cacti specifically for mescaline. That's not really the purposes of why I grow, Church said. Although he's never taken mescaline, he's not against it. Maybe one day I will try that. Israel widens attack in Gaza. Military expands offensive, says efforts in south will be no less strength than in north, by Najib Jobain and Karim Chahayab of the Associated Press. Israel's ground offensive expanded to every part of the Gaza Strip, its military said Sunday, as it ordered more evacuations and vowed to hit South Gaza with no less strength than the fight that has reduced large parts of North Gaza to a moonscape. Heavy bombardment followed the evacuation orders, and Palestinians in the sealed-off territory bordering Israel and Egypt said they were running out of places to go. Many of Gaza's 2.3 million people fled to the south after Israel ordered civilians to leave the north in the early days of the war, which was sparked by the October 7th Hamas-led attack in Israel that killed about 1,200, mostly civilians. After dark, gunfire and shelling were heard in the central town of Deir el-Bala as flares lit the sky. Israeli drones buzzed overhead in Gaza's second-largest city, Khan Yunis. UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk urged an end to the war, saying civilian suffering was too much to bear. Residents said the military dropped leaflets calling Khan Yunis a dangerous combat zone and ordering them to move to the border city of Rafah or a coastal area in the southwest. Halima Abdel Rahman, a widow and mother of four, said she's stopped heeding such orders. She fled her home in October to an area outside Khan Yunis where she stays with relatives. The occupation tells you to go to this area, then they bomb it, she said by phone. The reality is that no place is safe in Gaza. They kill people in the north. They kill people in the south. The health ministry in Hamas-run Gaza said the death toll in the territory since October 7th has surpassed 15,500, with more than 41,000 wounded. The ministry does not differentiate between civilian and combatant deaths, but said 70% of the dead were women and children. A health ministry spokesman asserted that hundreds had been killed or wounded since a week-long ceasefire ended Friday. The majority of victims are still under the rubble, Ashraf Al-Qidra said. Hamas has been designated as a terrorist organization by the United States, Canada, and the European Union. Hopes for another temporary truce in Gaza faded as Israel called its negotiators home and senior Hamas official Osama Hamdan said talks on releasing furthermore hostages must be tied to a permanent ceasefire. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the war will continue until all its goals are achieved. One is to remove Hamas from power in Gaza. The earlier ceasefire facilitated the release of 105 of the roughly 240 Israeli and foreign hostages taken to Gaza during the October 7th attack, in exchange for 240 Palestinians imprisoned by Israel. Most of those released by both sides were women and children. White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby told NBC's Meet the Press the U.S. was working really hard for a resumption of negotiations. The United States, Israel's closest ally, has urged Israel to avoid significant new mass displacement and to do more to protect civilians. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris told Egypt's president that under no circumstances would the U.S. permit the forced relocation of Palestinians from Gaza or the West Bank, an ongoing siege of Gaza, or the redrawing of its borders. As Harris flew from Dubai and an appearance at the UN climate conference back to Washington, she spoke by phone with Israeli President Isaac Herzog. They discuss the situation in the West Bank, with Harris reiterating U.S. concerns with steps being taken that could escalate tensions, including extremist settler violence, according to a summary provided by Harris's office. Harris also spoke by phone during the flight to Mahmoud Abbas, head of the Palestinian Authority, and again stated U.S. support for the Palestinian people's right to security, dignity, and self-determination, according to the summary. On the ground in Gaza, there was fear and mourning. Outside a Gaza City hospital, a dust-covered boy named Saad Khalid Shetta dropped to his knees beside the bloodied body of his little brother Mohammed, one of several bodies laid out after people said their street was hit by airstrikes. He kissed him. "You bury me with him," the boy cried. A health worker at Al-Ali Baptist Hospital said more than 15 children were killed. Israel's military said its fighter jets and helicopters struck targets in Gaza, including tunnel shafts, command centers, and weapons storage facilities. It acknowledged extensive aerial attacks in the Khan Yunis area. The bodies of 31 people killed in the bombardment of central Gaza were taken to the Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Balah, said Omar al-Darawi, a hospital administrative employee. One woman wept, cradling a child's body. Another carried the body of a baby. Later, hospital workers reported 11 more dead after another airstrike. Bloodied survivors included a child carried in on a mattress. Outside a hospital morgue in Khan Yunis, resident Sami El-Najila carried the body of a child. He said his sons had been preparing to evacuate their home, but the occupation didn't give us any time. The three-floor building was destroyed completely. The whole block was totally destroyed. He said six of the bodies were his relatives. Five people are still under the rubble, he said. God help us. In a video from the same crowded El Nasser hospital, UNICEF spokesperson James Elder said, "I feel like I'm almost failing in my ability to convey the endless killing of children here." Israel says it does not target civilians and has taken measures to protect them, including its evacuation orders. In addition to leaflets, the military has used phone calls and radio and TV broadcasts to urge people to move from specific areas. Israel says it targets Hamas operatives and blames civilian casualties on the group, accusing it of operating in residential neighborhoods. It claims to have killed thousands of terrorists without providing evidence. Israel says at least 78 of its soldiers have been killed. The widening offensive likely will further complicate humanitarian aid to Gaza. While Abu Omar, a spokesman for the Palestinian Crossings Authority, said 100 aid trucks entered Sunday, but UN agencies have said 500 trucks per day on average entered before the war. The United Nations estimates that 1.8 million Palestinians in Gaza have been displaced. Nearly 958,000 of them are packed into crowded UN facilities in the south, said Juliet Toma, director of communications at the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Elsewhere in the region, Lebanon's Hezbollah group said it struck Israeli positions near the tense Lebanon-Israel border. Eight soldiers and three civilians were wounded by Hezbollah fire in the area of Beit Hillel, Army Radio reported. The military said its artillery struck sources of fire from Lebanon and its fighter jets struck other Hezbollah targets. Iraqi militants with the Iran-backed umbrella group, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq, said they struck the Karab al-Jir U.S. military base in Syria with rockets. A U.S. military official, speaking on condition of anonymity in line with regulations, said rockets hit Rumelin landing zone in Syria, but there were no reports of casualties or damage. Later Sunday, officials with Iranian-backed militias in Iraq said five militia members were killed in an airstrike blamed on the U.S. near Kirkuk. The officials spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to comment publicly. A U.S. official who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss a military operation not yet made public said the U.S. had carried out a self-defense strike near Kirkuk, targeting a drone staging site. group targets childhood vaccination mandates by Cheryl Gay Stolberg of the New York Times. For more than 40 years, Mississippi had one of the strictest school vaccination requirements in the nation, and its high childhood immunization rates have been a source of pride. But in July, the state began excusing children from vaccination if their parents cited religious objections after a federal judge sided with the medical freedom group. Today, 2,100 Mississippi school children are officially exempt from vaccination on religious grounds. 500 more are exempt because their health precludes vaccination. Dr. Daniel P. Edney, the state health officer, warns that if the total number of exemptions climbs above 3,000, Mississippi will once again face the risk of deadly diseases that are now just a memory. For the last 40 years, our main goal has been to protect those children at highest risk of measles, mumps, rubella, polio, Edney said in an interview, and that's those children that have chronic illnesses that make them more vulnerable. He called the ruling a very bitter pill for me to swallow. Mississippi is not an isolated case. Buoyed by their success at overturning coronavirus mandates, medical and religious freedom groups are taking aim at a new target. Childhood school vaccine mandates, long considered the foundation of the nation's defense against infectious disease. Until the Mississippi ruling, the state was one of only six that refused to excuse students from vaccination for religious or philosophical reasons. Similar legal challenges have been filed in the five remaining states: California, Connecticut, Maine, New York, and West Virginia. The ultimate goal, according to advocates, is to undo vaccine mandates entirely by getting the issue before a Supreme Court that is increasingly sympathetic to religious freedom arguments. No major religions, including Roman Catholicism, which strongly opposes abortion, have objected to vaccination. But the plaintiffs in these cases say their religious objections stem in part from the use of fetal tissue in vaccine development. A few childhood vaccines, including those that protect against chickenpox and rubella, were developed with cells obtained from aborted fetuses in the early 1960s. Those cells continue to grow in laboratories today. The legal push comes as childhood vaccine exemptions have reached a new high in the United States, according to a report released last month by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. 3% of children who entered kindergarten last year received an exemption, the CDC said, up from 1.6% in the 2011-12 school year. Idaho had the highest rate of exemptions at 12%, while West Virginia had the lowest at less than 0.1%. Mississippi's rate was nearly as low at 0.2%. At the time, Mississippi allowed exemptions for medical reasons, but it did not yet allow parents to opt out on religious grounds. A broad majority of Americans continue to believe in the value of childhood vaccines. But in a Pew Research Center survey conducted in March, 28% of respondents said that parents should be able to choose not to vaccinate their children, up 12 percentage points from 4 years ago. Preventing deaths. Public health experts regard vaccination as a singular triumph. The World Health Organization says up to 5 million deaths worldwide are prevented each year by vaccines for diseases like diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, influenza, and measles. In the U.S., measles once killed 400 to 500 people each year, and whooping cough deaths numbered in the thousands, while polio left more than 15,000 paralyzed, according to the CDC. If vaccination rates dip much below 95%, public health experts warn, those diseases will become more than just a memory. It's a dangerous game we're playing, said Dr. Paul A. Offit, director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. If we eliminate school vaccine mandates, measles will be the first vaccine-preventable disease to come back, and it will come roaring back. Why would we want to put children in harm's way again? The Mississippi case offers a window into the political forces shaping these trends. The plaintiffs in the case included members of Mississippi Parents for Vaccine Rights, a group founded in 2012 by Mary Jo Perry, who said in an interview that her path into advocacy began after her youngest son, now 20, experienced seizures following routine vaccination. A large-scale study of more than 265,000 children identified 383 who had vaccine-related seizures, or less than 0.2%. Nearly all children who have post-vaccination seizures recover completely. Perry said that while her son had not had ongoing issues, the experience was terrifying. She said her son's pediatrician repeatedly requested a medical exemption from the state health department, but was refused. Edney said that Mississippi's current practice was to grant a medical exemption if a doctor requested one. "I felt like it was a nightmare, like I was being terrorized by my own government," Perry said. Years of activism. Mississippi had a religious exemption until the state's Supreme Court struck it down in 1979, reasoning that protecting Mississippi school children against the horrors of crippling and death from polio and other infectious diseases superseded religious claims. The state has had high childhood vaccination rates as a result. "For many, many years, it was one of the few things that Mississippi has done well," said Dr. Anita S. Henderson, a pediatrician in Hattiesburg and a past president of the state's chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. "States have long had the legal authority to require vaccination as a condition of school enrollment. As far back as 1905, the Supreme Court ruled in Jacobson versus Massachusetts that a state had the right to protect itself against an epidemic by requiring citizens to be vaccinated against smallpox or pay a fine. The judge, Halil Suleiman Ozerdan, made his ruling final in August, finding that Mississippi's vaccination requirement had violated the constitutional rights of the plaintiffs, who he said had sincerely held religious beliefs about vaccination. Cities Cracking Down on Homeless Encampments, by Claire Rush, Janie Haar, and Michael Casey of the Associated Press. Tossing tent poles, blankets, and a duffel bag into a shopping cart and three wagons, Will Taylor spent a summer morning helping friends tear down what had been their home and that of about a dozen others. It wasn't the first time and wouldn't be the last. Contractors for the city of Portland had arrived to break down the stretch of tents and tarps on a side street behind a busy intersection. People had an hour to vacate the encampment, one of more than a dozen cleared that July day, according to city data. Whatever they couldn't take with them was placed in clear plastic bags, tagged with the date and location of the removal, and sent to an 11,000-square-foot warehouse storing thousands like them. "It can get hard," said Taylor, 32, who has been swept at least three times in the 4 years he's been homeless. "It is what it is. I just let it go." Angelique Risby, 29, watched as workers in neon yellow vests shoveled piles of litter into black garbage bags. Risby, who has been homeless for 2 years, said she was prepared for a drill she's done multiple times. "Everything that I own," she said, "can fit on my wagon." Tent encampments have long been a fixture of the West Coast cities, but are now spreading across the U.S. The federal count of homeless people reached 580,000 last year, driven by lack of affordable housing, a pandemic that economically wrecked households, and lack of access to mental health and addiction treatment. Records obtained by the Associated Press show attempts to clear encampments increased in cities from Los Angeles to New York as public pressure grows to address what some residents say are dangerous and unsanitary living conditions. But despite tens of millions of dollars spent in recent years, there appears to be little reduction in the number of tents propped up on sidewalks, in parks, and by freeway off-ramps. Homeless people and their advocates say the sweeps are cruel and a waste of taxpayer money. They say the answer is more housing, not crackdowns. The AP submitted data requests to 30 U.S. cities regarding encampment sweeps and received at least partial responses from about half. In Phoenix, the number of encampments swept soared to more than 3,000 last year from 1,200 in 2019. Las Vegas removed about 2,500 camps through September, up from 1,600 in 2021. And in Minneapolis, camp removals have more than doubled from last year to 44 through November 9th, according to city records. But even officials at cities that don't collect data confirm that public camping is consuming more of their time, and they are starting to track numbers, budget for security and trash disposal, and beef up or launch programs to connect homeless people to housing and services. We are seeing an increase in these laws at the state and local level that criminalize homelessness, and it's really a misguided reaction to this homelessness crisis, said Scout Katovich, a staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union, which has filed lawsuits challenging the constitutionality of sweeps and property seizures in a dozen cities, including Minneapolis, Miami, Albuquerque, Anchorage, and Boulder. These laws and these practices of enforcement do nothing to actually alleviate the crisis, and instead they keep people in the vicious cycle of poverty, she said. But California Governor Gavin Newsom, whose state is home to nearly one-third of the country's homeless population, says leaving hazardous makeshift camps to fester is neither compassionate nor an option. He is among Democratic and Republican leaders urging the U.S. Supreme Court to take up a controversial Ninth Circuit Appellate Court ruling that prohibits local governments from clearing encampments without first assuring everyone living there is offered a bed indoors. San Francisco, which has sued by the ACLU of Northern California last year for its sweeps and property seizures, is under a court order to enforce the ruling. I hope this goes to the Supreme Court, said Newsom, a former mayor of San Francisco, in a September interview with news outlet Politico. And that's a hell of a statement coming from a progressive Democrat. In November, crews in Denver erected metal fencing as police officers called to residents to leave an encampment covering several downtown blocks. A bonfire blazed against temperatures in the teens, and snow covered the ground around tents. The word sweep that they use, that's kind of how it feels, like being swept like trash, said David Schoberg, 35. I mean, we're not trash, we're people. He said he and his wife would wander a couple blocks from here and see if we get yelled at for being there. David Eller Jr., 52, left the encampment with his toiletries, a sleeping bag, tent, and a propane heater. Eller has been homeless in Denver for about 2 years after a friend kicked him out. He said work was hard to come by in Connecticut, where he lived before Colorado, and the public has no idea how big a problem homelessness is. It started ever since the COVID people losing their jobs, losing their houses, losing their apartments, losing everything, he said, and this is where they end up. Sometimes numbers can't explain what a city is doing. The city of Los Angeles said its sanitation department responded to more than 4,000 requests a month from the public at the end of 2022 to address homeless encampments, double the amount the previous year. But the agency would not explain whether that meant the encampment was dismantled or simply cleaned around, or how large the encampments were, directing the AP to the city attorney's website for definitions. The city defines an encampment as a place where at least one person is living outdoors. In contrast, Portland clears some 19 encampments every day on average, according to the mayor's office. Crews have shut down nearly 5,000 camps in the city of 650,000 since November 2022, but residents continue to report new clusters that need to be dismantled. Crews have even found bodies of overdose victims in tents, said Sarah Angel, operations manager for the contractor that clears encampments for the city. If we never cleaned a camp in the city of Portland, I just don't know what Portland would look like, she said. I don't think that we're making it better by moving them, but I don't think that we're making it worse. Removing encampments is costly, an expense more cities, counties, and states have to budget for. Several cities queried by the AP provided some cost breakdowns, but officials at others said comprehensive costs were difficult to get given the multiple departments involved, including police, sanitation, and public health. Denver reported spending nearly $600,000 on labor and waste disposal in 2021 and 2022 to clean about 230 large encampments, some more than once. Phoenix said it spent nearly $1 million last year to clear encampments. Despite all that spending, said Masood Samari, little seems to change on the streets. The San Francisco real estate broker has seen businesses lose customers because of people camped on sidewalks, some clearly in mental distress, and he wants tents gone. It's throwing money at it without any tangible or any real results, Samory said. Being homeless is supposed to be a temporary event, he added. Unfortunately, it's becoming a way of life, and that is 100% incorrect. For homeless people, sweeps can be traumatizing. They often lose identification documents as well as cell phones, laptops, and personal items. They lose their connection to a community they've come to rely on for support. Roxanne Simonson, 60, said she had a panic attack during one of the four times she was swept in Portland. She recalled feeling dangerously overheated in her tent. I started yelling at them, "Call an ambulance, I can't breathe," and then I changed my mind because if I go, then I would lose all my stuff, she said. And yet cities can't stand by and do nothing, said Sam Dodge, who oversees encampment removals for the city of San Francisco. His department, created by the mayor in 2018, coordinates multiple agencies to place people into housing so crews can clear tents. Saying, "This is not working, this is dangerous, you can do better than this, you have a brighter future than this," I think that's caring for people, said Dodge, who has worked with homeless people for more than two decades. It seems immoral to me to just let people waste away. One August morning, Dodge and his crew surveyed about a dozen structures and tents some inches away from vehicles zipping by. Four outreach workers fanned out, asking people if they had a case manager or wanted shelter indoors. Police officers stood by as Department of Public Works employees, masked and wearing gloves, hauled away a rolled-up carpet. The block was crammed with bicycles, ladders, chairs, mattresses, buckets, cooking pots, shoes, and cardboard. City officials are particularly frustrated by people who have housing but won't stay in it. Michael Johnson, 40, has been homeless in San Francisco for 6 years. Before that, he lived with his pregnant girlfriend and was a driver for a commuter van tech startup, but he lost his job and their baby died. He was assigned a coveted one-room prefabricated structure with a bed, desk, and chair, a window, and locking door, but his friends aren't there, and to him it feels like jail, so he's sleeping in a tent. At his tent, friends hang out, including Cherise Haley, 31, who says shelter rules can make grown-ups feel like children. She left one shelter because residents weren't allowed to keep room keys and had to ask staff to get in. "Then you get pushed somewhere else," she said. "There's too many directions, but never an end solution." There are many reasons why people might reject shelter, say homeless people and their advocates. Some have been assaulted at shelters or had their belongings stolen. Sometimes they don't want to pare down their belongings or follow rules that prohibit drugs and drinking, officials say. Of the 20 people at the San Francisco encampment, 6 accepted temporary housing and 7 declined, said Frances Zamora, a spokesperson for the Department of Emergency Management at the time of the August operation. 2 people already had housing and 5 wouldn't communicate with outreach workers, Zamora said. The city has connected more than 1,500 people to housing this year. It's unclear, however, if they remain housed. Many cities say they link camp residents to housing, but track records are mixed. Homeless people and their advocates say there are not nearly enough temporary beds, permanent housing, or social services for drug or behavioral health counseling, so people caught up in sweeps just get kicked down the road. In New York City, more than 2,300 people were forcibly removed from encampments from March to November 2022, according to a June report from Comptroller Brad Lander. Only 119 accepted temporary shelter, but just 3 eventually got permanent housing. Meanwhile, tent encampments had returned to a third of the sites surveyed. They just totally failed to connect people to shelter or to housing, Lander, who opposes sweeps, told the AP. If you're going to help them, you have to build trust with them to move them into housing and services. The sweeps really went in the opposite direction. A spokesperson for Democratic New York City Mayor Eric Adams, Charles Lutvik, disagreed. He said 70% of campsites cleared were not reestablished and homeless residents accepted offers of shelter at a rate 6 times higher than under the previous administration. Despite the inherent difficulty of this work, our efforts have been indisputably successful, Lutvik said in a statement. The city of Phoenix cleared out a massive downtown homeless encampment by a court-ordered deadline in November and said it had helped more than 500 people find beds in shelters and motels. Encampments were not a serious issue in Minneapolis until the pandemic, when they became more commonplace and much larger, drawing thousands of complaints. In response, the city closed down more than 2 dozen sites where 383 people were camped from March 2022 until February. At the same time, Hennepin County, which includes Minneapolis, launched a program last year aimed at finding short and long-term housing for homeless people, including some living in encampments. We are hyper-focused on housing, said Danielle Werder, manager of the county's Office to End Homelessness. We're not walking around with socks and water bottles. We're walking around saying, what do you need? In Portland, the encampment dismantled in July was cleared again in September and November. 2 dozen newly installed boulders helped keep the camp from being reestablished along parts of the sidewalk. Kieran Hartnett, who's lived in the neighborhood for 7 years, said there was fighting, drug use, open fires, and vehicle break-ins around the encampment. Some tents were on grass just outside his house, which was particularly stressful when people started acting in erratic ways. He hopes the people moved from the site are getting help. I understand the argument that clearing them just moves them to somewhere else and they don't really have a better place to go, he said. On the same account, I feel like you can't allow things to just fester. There's not a good solution to it, he said. CU researchers find transplanting stem cells into brains can be safe. Larger trial needed to tell whether stem cells slow disease's progression, by Meg Wingerter of the Denver Post. A trial involving researchers at the University of Colorado found it can be safe to transplant stem cells into the brains of people with at least one disabling illness, but the science has a long way to go before people heal with cells from embryos or their own bodies. The trial, involving scientists in Colorado, the United Kingdom, and Italy, infused stem cells taken from the brain of a fetus that had died in a miscarriage into 15 Italian patients who already had significant disabilities caused by multiple sclerosis. In the year after the infusions, the patients' multiple sclerosis didn't get worse, and they didn't have severe side effects from the stem cells. It will take a bigger trial with a comparison group that didn't receive the treatment to know whether the stem cells truly slowed down the disease's progression, though, said Angelo Di Alessandro, a professor at CU's Anschutz Medical Campus. The disease was overall stable, he said. In multiple sclerosis, the immune system attacks a substance called myelin that coats cells in the nervous system. As the myelin wears away, the nerve cells lose the ability to communicate with each other, gradually leading to problems with walking and other daily tasks, Alessandro said. Some people's illnesses progress much faster than others, and not everyone has all of the symptoms, which can include vision problems, muscle weakness, pain or loss of sensation, fatigue, and difficulty speaking. Scientists have talked about stem cells as a possible solution to degenerative diseases like multiple sclerosis for decades, because while medication can prevent dramatic flare-ups of the disease, there's no way to stop gradual loss of function over time, said Dr. Michael Tsai, a neurologist at the University of California, Irvine. This particular study showed that infusing stem cells into the brain can be done safely, but didn't suggest patients could expect dramatic improvement from these types of transplants anytime soon, he said. Commercialization of stem cell technologies has gotten well ahead of science, though. The only approved treatments using stem cells are bone marrow transplants, but in 2021, researchers found more than 2,700 clinics operated in the United States offering to use embryonic stem cells or cells from patients' own fat to treat a variety of diseases. Some patients have gone blind or developed tumors after receiving stem cell injections. At the beginning of human development, stem cells could form any type of cell in the body, but they gradually take on specialties. The donated cells in the multiple sclerosis trial could only become brain tissue at that point, reducing the odds they'd develop into tumors. Previous studies in rodents and non-human primates engineered to have a disease like multiple sclerosis found that the transplanted cells went to the parts of their brains that had lesions and appeared to partially repair them, Alessandro said. It's not clear if the same thing would happen in humans, but those that received larger doses in the trial had more significant changes in the fluid surrounding their brains and spines that suggested their cells were healthier, he said. It's possible that a small percentage of the stem cells converted into cells in the brain, replacing damaged ones, Alessandro said. Stem cells can also give their mitochondria, the powerhouses of cells, to the existing neurons, which could reduce inflammation in the brain, he said. All of the 15 patients in the trial were middle-aged and had advanced forms of multiple sclerosis with significant disability. Even if subsequent trials find a benefit for that group, it's not clear if different types of patients would find it helpful. Stem cell transplants likely wouldn't be a first line of treatment. To deliver the cells into the brain, doctors had to cut a hole in the patient's skull, a process that comes with the risk of injury or introducing an infection. It's possible that this approach won't pan out, but even in that case, it might advance the field for others to try something else, Alessandro said. The researchers are planning a second trial to quantify if the stem cells produced benefits, but aren't enrolling patients in Colorado at this point. This can give patient hope, he said. In sports, Texas backstep. 5-game win streak ends in Houston with defense generating 0 takeaways. Wilson pick in end zone extinguishes Broncos rally, last of 3 interceptions by Parker Gabriel of the Denver Post. The difference between a groove and a rut is all about the edges. Run a string down the center line of either and you'll find few impediments. On the margins, though, a groove is smooth, precise, designed to allow an object already in motion to stay in motion. A rut is rough around the edges, bouncy, always threatening to knock a traveler off kilter, or in this case, knock the Broncos off a miracle playoff run just as it picked up steam. Denver's postseason hopes aren't dead after a frustrating, ruddy 22-17 loss at Houston, but its path narrowed considerably Sunday when it came up 8 yards short of victory. Disappointing loss, head coach Sean Payton said. Thought we were sloppy for most of the game. The fine line distinguishing grooves from ruts has been Payton's preferred metaphor all season. First, he used it as a battle cry during Denver's slow start, then as a warning against complacency as his team got hot. Now it's representative of the minuscule gap between success and failure in the NFL. A 7-5 with tiebreakers over Buffalo, Cleveland, and the Texans, the Broncos wouldn't have just been grooving. They'd have been rolling out of Harris County on an I-10 express lane toward wildcard weekend. At 6-6, functionally 2 games behind the Texans, and looking up at a clump of others, the Broncos' path to the postseason is now more akin to landing the space shuttle. Houston, the Broncos have a problem. A postseason push is still possible if the Broncos get the best and the brightest down the stretch, but there's little margin for error remaining. Take it one game at a time, and the chips will fall as they may. Denver right tackle Mike McGlinchey said after the second loss, if we take care of business week in and week out and continue to prepare the way we have been preparing for the last month or two, I think we can still do some damage. On Sunday, though, damage of the self-inflicted variety cost the Broncos dearly. Denver hadn't been great on third downs or in the red zone this year, 17th and 21st in the NFL respectively, but against the Texans, they struggled mightily in both departments. Most glaringly, Denver didn't convert a single one of its 11 third-down tries despite a manageable average to go distance of 5.5 yards. They made up for it slightly with a trio of fourth-down conversions, but too often failed to move the chains when they had chances. Quarterback Russell Wilson entered play with a 110.7 quarterback rating on third down. against Houston, 2 of 5 for 5 yards, an interception and 2 sacks plus 3 rushing attempts for 15 yards. They did a good job of stopping us on third downs, Wilson said. We had some key plays on first and second downs that could have given us a little bit more action down the field and in the run game. They did a good job making it third and medium, third and long a couple of times. We've got to find a way. Third down is all about finding a way. Wilson had been similarly surgical in the red zone, despite Denver's modest numbers overall, entering Sunday with 17 touchdown passes and no turnovers. Against Houston, 2 of 7 for 10 yards and a rushing touchdown, but also the game-sealing interception on third and goal from the 8-yard line in the waning seconds. That final fateful play wasn't all on Wilson, of course. Texans edge rusher Jonathan Greenyard ripped past left tackle Garrett Bowles and got pressure in 1.95 seconds, forcing Wilson to ad lib. Confusion among the Broncos' troops set to the left didn't help matters either. Absent a spectacularly placed heave from Denver's quarterback, and we've seen a few of those this season, he needed an overthrow rather than an underthrow. The difference between a groove and a rut in maybe 2 feet of end zone airspace. An even finer line, the squirting ball that Broncos edge rusher Jonathan Cooper is likely to see in his sleep, which was emblematic of a turn of fortunes in the turnover department. Brilliant Texans rookie quarterback C.J. Stroud fumbled on a hit by Denver nickel Jaquan McMillan late in the third quarter at Houston's 29-yard line, and Cooper appeared to recover the ball only to have it pop away. At one point, it appeared the 4 closest players to it had the white visiting uniform on. Instead of the game-turning takeaway the Broncos have relied on in recent weeks, though, Houston running back Dare Ogunbowale pounced on it. The difference between a groove and a rut and a few bounces of an oblong ball. Instead of 1st and 10, Denver in scoring position, Houston punted the ball away. One play later came the first of Wilson's 3 picks, all of which came in the final 16 minutes. The difference between a groove and a rut altered by the hand of Houston edge rusher Will Anderson Jr., who deflected Wilson's pass for Jerry Jeudy. As subtle as the redirection was, it started a major reversal of the Broncos' biggest recent strength. Over the past 5 games, they forced 16 takeaways and went plus 13 in the turnover department. In a span of 45 seconds on the game clock Sunday, they essentially went minus 2. Overall, Denver's minus 3 mark tied for worst of the season with the Week 3 debacle at Miami, which also the last time they failed to take the ball away in a game. We didn't play our best football, and we're going to have to down the stretch here, Peyton said. The Broncos put themselves in this position. They started the season in a 1-5 slumber, just like they started Week 13 with 5 punts and a measly field goal. They roared back into contention over the ensuing 5 games, just like they did late in the game Sunday. With the way the season started, and then where we're at right now, the margin for error is obviously slim, Peyton said, and yet we're playing for a lot. They might need another 5-game winning streak to extend their season. At the least, they've got to win the final 4 AFC games on their slate. 2 against the Los Angeles Chargers, Christmas Eve against New England, and a season closer at Las Vegas. Those are all winnable games, but in total, they still represent a mighty fine line. Grooves only, no ruts allowed. Broncos mess around, get clowned by rookie QB Stroud by Mark Kisla of the Denver Post. The Broncos messed around with the Texans and found out. The arms of Denver quarterback Russell Wilson are too short to fight with emerging Houston star C.J. Stroud. Even worse, Broncos linebacker Alex Singleton got clowned by Stroud for trying to intimidate a brash NFL rookie who refuses to blink. "I'm going to stand on business," Stroud said Sunday when he led Houston to a 22-17 victory. For Denver, this loss hurt far beyond the heart-wrenching end of a 5-game winning streak and the damage done to its improbable playoff run. If the Broncos fall short of the Super Bowl tournament, this failed comeback will be a prominent and ugly chapter in their book of regrets. "You hate losing," quarterback Russell Wilson said. For a full 30 minutes after he threw an interception in the end zone during the final seconds of the fourth quarter, Wilson sat on a chair in front of his locker, wearing his stained number 3 uniform and cleats, and refused to hit the showers to wash away the bitter taste of defeat. He threw zero interceptions during the winning streak, but three against the Texans, with the final one on an ill-advised 50-50 ball to the end zone with 16 seconds remaining on the clock. Even worse, instead of throwing to Cortland Sutton or somebody we all know, Wilson decided to chuck it in a small window to tight end Lucas Kroll. Say what? And more important, who? At the most crucial juncture to this point in the season, the best available option was Kroll, who had been targeted with only one other pass all year. Really? With all the options on Coach Sean Payton's big play card, what was Kroll even doing in the game? Far be it for me to challenge the offensive genius of Payton, but did the coach maybe listen too much to his inner giant and got a little too annexation of Puerto Rico with that call? Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.